Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks very much for listening on Friday, May 1st, 2015. Welcome to May on In Depth with Francis Rose. The Federal News Countdown every Friday features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. My experts on this week's Federal News Countdown. It's kind of a little mini OMB reunion. It's Jeff Cook. It's good to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks.
And Jonathan Bruhl, it is good to see you as always, my friend.
Great to be here.
You have each chosen three terrific stories as the three most important federal news stories of the week, and we will start at
number three.
And Jeff Cook, your choice as the third most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. Government agencies don't like bring your own device policy. Now, I have to say, I was surprised to see that this story was in the newspaper because I didn't know that anybody had gone out and done this research, as the Post reports that Forrester Research did. But I'm not surprised by the results. I remember the gasps when Vivek Kundra first said this is something that they were going to allow and something to pursue. And a lot of IT professionals have said in between then and now, on the record, we're making it work and so on. I can't remember the last time I heard one off the record say that it was something they were really psyched about.
Yeah, and this seemed to be a policy that was pushed out. It was enthusiastically endorsed, but as you say, it at some point ran into the real problem of security, of liability for these devices, and the fact that if you use your own device, the idea is a convenience to the worker. But I think given that the average federal salary now is something on the order of $80,000, if that person has an important job to do of inspecting airplanes or meat or workplace safety, you can certainly afford a $500 or $1,000 device for that person to use, particularly if you can then optimize the security and the usability and features of that device rather than having to accommodate a whole menagerie of different possible device types.
I want to point out that this work that Forrester Research did is not limited to the federal government. It's agencies all across the government spectrum in the United States. But the trend line here is bad for people who are proponents of BYOD too, Jeff. A year ago, the numbers were better in favor of bring your own device.
Yeah, and it's trending downward, and I think part of that is because there's a line from the report which I didn't buy, but it's excerpted that says the hype is over. I think it was a good idea. I think people reacted that way because frequently people have very sexy, neat devices on their own, and they have a BlackBerry or something from work.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, I think if you need the job done, if you need a government employee to have a device to collect data, to do their job, do their analysis, that needs to be part of the fully loaded cost of that person, including their wage, their benefits, office space, management overhead, and a device for them to carry around.
The hype is over concept also fits with another quote here. Many government officials, this story says, regard those programs, BYOD programs, as more trouble than they're worth. And that's been the complaint about them that I've heard all along.
I think CIOs across, and federal program managers in general have a focus on getting their job done. Their job is important. And to add to that confusion by saying to them that they must support an infinite array of various device types as well is adding unnecessary confusion, increasing the cost of the programs, and decreasing the likelihood of success of those programs.
I'm no expert on any of this by any stretch of the imagination, but when Vivek first proposed this idea, it struck me that one possibility was like a hot list. Here are the devices that we know as they come out of the box are fine to use on government networks. That didn't happen. And I wonder now, in hindsight, what, 3 or 4 years later, maybe longer, if that's even a practical thing anymore with the explosion in the number and types of devices that are out there.
Well, and what exactly are we talking about? If you're saying, I want to be able to get email on my device that I happen to be carrying, you're not supposed to send personally identifiable information or classified information through email anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's fine. Maybe a phone call is fine. But actually using that device in the course of inspecting an airplane, or photographing an accident scene on your personal device versus having a federal agency-issued device, I think the value is limited, and the compromises that you have to go through to accommodate all these devices overwhelms that.
Jeff Cook's third most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline, government agencies don't like bring your own device policy. And you can find that in all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Jonathan Brule, your choice at number three is my colleague Jason Miller's story from federalnewsradio.com. Presidential rank awardees demonstrate the value of public service. And this is the big kahuna, and it's back this year after taking a one-year hiatus, essentially. And the work that these folks do is just as impressive as all of the presidential rank award winners in the past. What'd you take away from this ceremony, the awards themselves, and from what Jason wrote about them, Jonathan?
Well, the administration revived the awards. It took a hiatus for budget sequestration last year. And fortunately, it was revived and put back in business, but not too many. That was the other part of the story that, 24 people got awards?
Yes.
And, you know, we've had as many as, 70 or 80 in 2 or 3 years ago. So it's not what it used to be. But I think there was $32 billion worth of savings attributed to the award winners.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's real serious money. The kinds of things they are recommending, a crop insurance program that was saving $2 billion a year. Someone spearheaded a questionable IRS tax returns worth $2 billion. And there was an HHS one that settled healthcare fraud for $2.3 billion. So these people are doing fantastic work, and you can do nothing but applaud it. And, if you want an organization to excel, you've got to focus on what they do well,
mm-hmm.
and not what they've just been messing up. So, again, this focuses on what people are doing well and what should be applauded.
It's a thread that fits with what we were talking about, actually, before we went on the air. I have a conversation at federalnewsradio.com later today with Congressman Mark Meadows, who's the chairman of the new Government Operations Subcommittee on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. And I confess I came away from my conversation with him and reading the op-ed that he has posted on federalnewsradio.com cautiously optimistic that he's willing to discuss these issues, that he wants to highlight the work that's being done well, as well as highlighting the problems that are going on in agencies. And if that happens, and if his subcommittee, whose ranking member is Jerry Conley, we all know what his record is as far as federal employees and the viability of the federal workforce, if that subcommittee winds up focusing on best practices and focusing on things that have gone well, that could turn out to be a great piece of leverage for trying to maybe change minds across the Republican caucus.
Well, not too long ago, there weren't too many politicians who even wanted to be seen with a federal employee, mm-hmm. giving him a check or some sort of award. So again, having this award, having it at the State Department in the diplomatic reception rooms, and being seen with these people is really a major step forward and something that should be continued.
The only complaint, there was two main complaints that I heard about this. One of them was the number of people who got them, as you talked about earlier. Yeah. And I think one can also argue last year there were zero. So the fact that there were 24 honorees for the Distinguished Rank Awards and 89 Meritorious mm-hmm. Rank Awards is better than we had last year, certainly better than 2012, excuse me. The other complaint that I heard, which I think may be justified, is where was President Obama ever at any of these?
He's AWOL on all these. It's in his name as president, but he's not been personally involved.
Jonathan Brule's choice as the third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. Presidential rank awardees demonstrate the value of public service. And you can find that story and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important stories of the week is selected by Jeff Cook and Jonathan Brule. Back in a moment on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Jeff Cook and Jonathan Brule, and we're up to
number two.
Jeff Cook, your choice is the second most important federal news story of the week is from Roll Call, and the headline is One Down, 11 to Go, GOP's Uncertain Appropriations Season. I guess the silver lining, yes, there's a lot of uncertainty still about this. The silver lining that I see is that it's happening, at least. I mean, I went back and looked at May of 2014 and May of 2013, and we weren't anywhere near this far along, even on the House side, which was Republican in both of us. So we can't say it's really a partisan thing, I don't think. Somebody turned a light switch on or something and decided we really need to get about the business here.
Yeah, and I think that is a goal of the Republican leadership. They're trying to show that they can run on regular order for appropriations, which has not been done in a long time. There were staffers on the Hill that had never seen regular order. So this is their goal, to both do that and make sure that people perceive that. The headline here should have been changed. It's now 2 down and 10 to go. They actually passed energy water this morning. So they're one step ahead. One thing, though, is last year I looked it up as well, and because I was curious, what was the, you know, what and when did they pass the first bill? Because I was, I believe, on the show about this time last year, and we were making the same remarks. Isn't it nice to see that appropriations is moving forward? And last year, on exactly the same bill, April 30, they passed the same appropriations bill, MILCON. It was the first one out of the gate. And then all of a sudden, the train came off the tracks with the DHS funding and with the immigration debate that went on for the year. The difference last year was that they didn't have a joint budget resolution, which is the agreement between the House and the Senate about what the budgets will be and how to proceed with them. The benefit of that is a budget and a joint budget resolution hadn't been passed since 2010. The benefit of that joint resolution is it allows a procedure called reconciliation, which is a mechanism to avoid a filibuster in the House. So it's not to say the bills will certainly be passed, but they will be brought to a vote. And if somebody wants to vote against appropriation bills and stop the funding of the government, they're going to have to put a vote on record for it rather than just not allowing the vote to go forward.
The chairman of the House committee that puts out the MILCON bill every year is Charlie Dent, and he will be on the program with me next week to talk about that process, what MILCON looks like, the justification behind it, and all of that. One of the problems that he's up against is, I don't imagine you both read about the VA hospital in Colorado that is now $1.3 billion over its original cost estimate. And that money's got to come from somewhere. So it will be interesting to hear Chairman Dent talk about where you find $1.3 billion in a $77 billion bill.
And who's going to do the work? Mm-hmm. And I've even heard they're talking about bringing in the Army Corps of Engineers
to do the work. Corps has taken over the project management from the Department of Veterans Affairs because of the issues that VA's had with that. And there's horror stories out of that. The problem is that ties back, Jonathan, to what we just talked about in story number three. Is that, yes, it's we can be hopeful that members of Congress will still want to talk about the good things that agencies do, and yet there are places where we still continue to see big stumbles.
Well, big stumbles, but I think there's more to the Jeff story than that we were talking about. The Republicans have chosen to up the president's budget to about $30 billion more for defense, and the caps come down on the domestic programs. So again, we're not out of the woods yet in terms of having a budget and having agreement on how the deal is going to be cut. And I think we may see some major problems down the road.
Just because of trying to reconcile what the White House is willing to sign compared to what Congress is willing to pass?
Well, there are all sorts of differences. Also, even within this bill, they funded 10 of the 15 recommendations on retirement, and the administration punted and said they wanted to study some of the rest. Well, usually by the time you get to appropriation bills, you have a darn good sense of whether you're for it or against it, and to just claim that you want to study it some more is either uncertainty or there's, I don't know.
The uncertainty that I guess that when I saw Secretary Carter's statement on the Comp Commission recommendations, which is what you're alluding to. I went back and looked, and the Comp Commission reported out either right at the same time as the budget request came out, or it was soon enough before the administration's budget came out, that I can understand it would have been really difficult to go back and rewrite the document or reconsider the document. So it's just the difference of the way we're looking at it. I might see a little more leeway for the administration there than you do. But I'm amazed that the Comp Commission reports recommendations, as many of them as there were, and as potentially controversial as some of them were, have swept through town. I mean, how many of these kinds of commissions have we seen in the time that all three of us have been in Washington where the report comes out, the notebook goes on the shelf, and we never hear anything about it again? So the fact that even that many, yes, you're right, there could be more deliberation on the other five and maybe a quicker response is warranted. But just the fact that it's getting any attention at all, I find tremendously encouraging.
I think the pressure here to find some cuts, to find some places to save money, the joint budget resolution is tasking Congress to find these savings, and not only in discretionary, but in mandatory programs as well. That's entitlement spending, and that is mind-bogglingly difficult to do. That difficulty is further exacerbated by a maneuver they did on the Milcon bill of adding money to wartime spending, which is not subject to caps, using it for some construction programs. I'm not saying it's a good or bad idea, but the left and the right came out against that. The left saying it wasn't enough spending. The right saying this is a leak in the cap and should be plugged. So it's going to be a difficult slog. Hopefully we won't end up in the straits that we were last year.
I don't think anybody wants to see that happen again.
The turn towards the regular order and trying to have a budget for once is the good news, and that I think there's a lot more interest in it now than there had been in the past. So
Jeff Cook's second most important federal news story of the week's from Roll Call. One down, 11 to go, and the update, of course, as Jeff pointed out, is correct. Two down now, 10 to go. GOP's uncertain appropriation season. And Jonathan, your choice is the second most important federal news story of the week's from Washington Post. The headline is "A Smooth Presidential Transition Can't Be Done in Just a Few Weeks." I'm pleased about this for a number of reasons. I recall, I believe my first presidential election at Federal News Radio was 2008. And I remember now President Obama announcing, I think it was midsummer or something like that, that he was forming a transition team. And he was going to, name some of the folks who were going to be involved, in putting that team together. And Senator McCain accused him immediately of, "You're measuring the drapes, you're presuming you're going to win," and all of that. And so the fact that in just 8 years we've come to a point where it seems to be at least more universally understood, if not completely universally understood, that it's very wise to do what the president did in that case and really be ready to take over on January 20th at noon, is very encouraging to me. And I'm happy to see the Partnership for Public Service getting some recognition for the work that they've been doing in trying to educate people about this issue and lead this issue. This story in the Post quotes Max Steyer, the head of the partnership, very extensively. And no matter who wins in 2016, the idea that they're getting cover to start earlier than ever to prepare for that transition can only turn out to be a good thing, can't it, Jonathan?
Yeah, there's lots of signals. Senator Carper on the Hill has been showing interest in this as well. And you're right, in the past, whether it was measuring the White House drapes or counting your chickens before they hatch, the jokes have made fun of this sort of effort. Given the complexities and the challenges inherent in managing the federal government, And in managing a transition, you've got to have a strong transition team and a strong process in place months ahead of time to start vetting employees, doing briefings on agencies, and basically being totally prepared to take over the moment the president is sworn in. And there's a wonderful book that'll come out, I think, in June or July this summer by Martha Kumar. She's a author, but also a White House historian who looked at the last administration and last transition and has documented how the transition was done last time. And she tells a marvelous story about the terrorist threats, which were aimed at the mall at the moment the president was going to be sworn in. And fortunately, they did not materialize. But the lesson that she draws is that the members of the outgoing administration and the members of the new incoming administration met. They had worked with each other for several months. They knew one another. They trusted each other, and they knew what each other did. And their execution of the plan to deal with matters, if anything occurred, was flawless.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you want, and that's what you need. And this effort is this is a necessary kind of thing that must go on, whether anyone knows about it or not.
Jeff, this story says the Partnership for Public Service will prepare a transition guide, offer it to every candidate, and encourage candidates to set up separate organizations to prepare nominations for the most important positions, take other steps to be ready. You can put together a transition guide. What's really important is what's in it. And what I think is terrific is a couple of things. The goal should be to have Congress confirm the 500 most important nominees Absolutely. Before it goes on recess in August of 2017. I mentioned the Obama election was my first election here at Federal News Radio, but the first one that I remember covering as a journalist was the first Clinton administration. And they had trouble getting nominees in place. And to be fair, the Bush administration did too at the beginning. This administration's had trouble at the beginning, empty spots well into the first full year of the term in some pretty high-level positions. So just the fact, again, that the partnership is calling attention to this very critical issue can only turn out to be a good thing, right?
Absolutely. And I think the efforts here are well spent. The transition, you know, we focus on the Senate confirmation of those, in this case, the 500 most important people. There's something between 1,200 and 1,400 Senate-confirmed positions in the government, and about that many that are not Senate-confirmed. And the Senate has taken steps. In 2012, they passed the Presidential Appointment Efficiency and Streamlining Act, which eliminated 163 of those positions from Senate confirmation. So the Senate has done their part to do this as well. The counterpoint to that would be, if we didn't grow the size of the government so much, we wouldn't have so many people to confirm, would we? But I think it's absolutely correct that the transition can't start too soon. And I was in the administration during the last transition, and the message from Josh Bolton, the president's chief of staff, was unambiguous to everyone that the transition was important. It was the most important thing. And we were to do everything to facilitate that. Partly, I think that was because of, as you mentioned, the terrorist threats and the fact that we were on a war footing with an unknown adversary. And I think part of it may have been a reaction to the very rocky transition, which had happened 8 years earlier with the Clinton to Bush transition, where there were the transition team did not get access to the swing space until after the Supreme Court decided Bush v. Gore.
Mm-hmm.
And there were the stories of miscellaneous things like the W's being pried off of computer keyboards. Josh Bolton was unambiguous that none of that was going to take place on our watch transitioning to the Obama administration. In part, though, the outcome of that election was much less ambiguous than the outcome of the previous election. And everybody was pretty sure who won that election.
Jonathan Brule's choice is the second most important federal news story of the week. It's from the Washington Post. A smooth presidential transition can't be done in just a few weeks. And my colleague Tom Temin talked to Max Steyer about this transition guide. You can find that at federalnewsradio.com/federal drive. And you can find all the stories from this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we continue, the most important federal news stories of the week, Jonathan Brule and Jeff Cook chose them. And you'll hear them coming up on In Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be right back. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown every week features the three most important federal news stories as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week it's Jeff Cook and Jonathan Brule, and we are up to
number one.
The top of the chart, the most important story as selected this week by Jonathan Brule is actually from the Brookings Institution's website, and it's titled, "Where Have All the Reinventors Gone? How Government Reform Will Shape the 2016 Election." Paul Light wrote this, and he's recognized Jonathan as a real expert on government organization and government reform. How likely do you think it really is, though, that people, as they choose who they're going to vote for in 2016 for president, will think about government reform or think about government organization or reorganization?
Well, it's a good question, and one we all ought to think about. I think events in the last 4 and 8 years have brought that problem home, whether it's the Obamacare website or the VA or the Secret Service. And the reason is that no one runs for president to run the government. Think about it, but Obama didn't come with any desire really to run the government. He had ideas and policies, and there were policies on national security, there were policies on economics, the health care. Running the government was not of concern or primary concern to him. But I think there's a good chance, if you listen to Paul Light's rationale, that 2016 will be different. And he has a quote at the end of this piece, and it's actually at the end of the much longer research piece that accompanies it. And it goes like this: "The time for small bore tinkering and unfulfilled promises is long overdue." He sees a major role for government reform and the way the government operates being an issue and being a consequence of the 2016 election.
And it's interesting that he sees an appetite for it, too. The presumption among elected officials is, well, people don't really want that to happen. He divides the electorate up into four categories: the reinventors, who want to maintain government programs and focus on inefficiency; the streamliners, who want to cut government programs and also focus on inefficiency; the priority setters, who want to maintain government programs but winnow the federal agenda to their liking; and the dismantlers, who want to cut government programs and also winnow the agenda to their very different liking. Now, I see that, Jeff, as kind of now I can't think of the term of it, when you have the circles and the Venn diagram.
It's a four square.
Or that too.
The magic quadrant.
So that's the kind of thing that I see here. And he writes that the shifting that's gone on here has been dramatic in the last several years. Percentage of Americans who support reinventing has been sliced in half since 2002. Those are the folks who want to keep the size the way it is, focus on inefficiency. The percentage who align with dismantling, that's the people who want to cut and change the agenda, has tripled since 2002. I mean, that's a dramatic reshaping of the landscape of the electorate, it sounds like to me.
Well, and I was challenged when I first read this article. I thought, I sort of thought the same thing, that somebody trying to run for president based on, you know, my ability to implement shared services across the government, that's going to be a tough slog for me.
Shocking.
But then I got to thinking, and you know what? Obama did run on this. What was his message? Hope and change. Okay, change. I think was a tilt at fatigue with President Bush, but hope. I think the message is, I can bring the resources of the federal government to bear for you. More powerful, more focused, better run government. That is sort of a liberal Democrat philosophy. The government is a big thing that we can use to fix big problems. President Bush's message, compassionate conservative, okay? That doesn't say I'm going to disassemble the government. It says I'm going to use the government for the things that the government is needed for, okay? That's a focus. That's more of that focus quadrant, that there are some things that the government is very good at and we should use it for, and I'm going to manage the government better. Reagan was famous for his line about government isn't the solution, government is the problem. He was a disassembler, and he said he was going to reduce the size of the government. And I was challenged. I was trying to think, well, what was Carter's message? Carter was an outsider, And if anything, the outsider is not going to be the guy who understands the mechanizations of this government. He was the guy who was going to bring it, you know, tame it down a little bit. Probably not a message normally associated with him, but that was the message that came through. So in a way, given the paper here, I was sort of able to convince myself that you could massage these people into saying they did at some point portray their ability to manage the government, to use the government for the things the government should do.
Do you like, Jonathan, these four categories that Paul has grouped the electorate into? You think they're comprehensive?
They work. The theory is that if two of the four groups coalesce and are strong, mm-hmm. they're going to have a majority of yep. the voters. And there's some possibilities here that a winning coalition can be put together that has a voice much stronger than we've heard in the past, and it deals with government reform. And, you know, if Light's correct, and he's been pretty savvy about these kind of issues in the past, it may be finally the time where government reform is a serious matter for the election.
You can wedge anything into four quadrants, you know, and I think these are the quadrants he's selected, and I think he does a justifiable job of putting people in them, and I think you could wrap them around actual candidates. You know, we could put talk shows into a quadrant here with argument versus conversation and analysis versus pablum.
Would mine be in the pablum quadrant?
No, you're in the magic quadrant.
Magic quadrant.
Right here.
Yeah.
The magic
analysis
quadrant.
Analysis.
Wow.
The upper right-hand corner.
And conversation.
Pretty amazing. I had no idea. Jonathan Brule's choice is the most important federal news story of the week is from the Brookings Institution. Where have all the reinventors gone? How government reform will shape the 2016 election. That and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, Jeff Cook's choice is the most important federal news story of the week to wrap up the federal news countdown next on Federal News Radio. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Jonathan Brule and Jeff Cook. And we're up to the most important story as selected by Jeff Cook, and it's my colleague Jason Miller's story, headlined, USCIO Tony Scott says OMB's draft FATARA guidance aims to advance IT reforms. And Jason actually talked to Tony Scott about this, and you can find that at federalnewsradio.com right now. It's an exclusive interview with Tony about how all of this will work and what OMB envisions here. Normally, my question to a guest is, why'd you choose this? I have a good idea of why you chose this. You're an IT guy, Jeff, and this is a really, really, really big deal.
It is. It is. This is the realization of things that we've been batting around in the community for years.
20 years.
20 years. It is. Klinger and Cohen said that the CIO was going to be the person primarily responsible. And when push came to shove, we found out that budgets are allocated at a bureau level. And the CIO a lot of times had little say-so over that budget. It might even be in a separate appropriations bill from the main agency. I mean, Forest Service is not in the agriculture bill. It's over in energy water, I think. And so sometimes CIOs were being held responsible for something that they had little control over. I know that we were talking about the MAX system during the break. The budget submission actually had to come through the CIO, but a lot of times he didn't get to see it before he hit send to send it over to OMB. Now the new bill here, FATARA, specifies that the CIO is to be involved in these decisions in a pre-submission basis to look at the budget planning. The scope of the CIO is to be both enterprise IT projects as well as program-specific IT projects, and they manage for the department, or they set the standards and process for capital planning, big projects, project management, metrics for reporting, and so this gives them statutorily this broad authority. The implementation guidelines here that OMB's posted tells agencies to interpret this and to give a plan back to OMB on how they're going to implement this. What decision-making authority the CIO is going to reserve unto him or herself, and what of those responsibilities he's going to delegate to a lower level. is going to document those delegations and tell how he's going to still be accountable, even if he's not performing and responsible for or actually getting that work performed. So that's the core of it. There's a large sections then that go ahead and codify administration initiatives around data center consolidation, strategic sourcing, the IT acquisition cadres. But the core of it up top is statutorily giving giving CIOs the authority that all too often they've been expected to have and didn't.
There's two pieces of this, two passages from Jason's story, Jonathan, that I'm curious if you agree with. He writes at the beginning of it, the one underlying message from OMB in the 31-page draft guidance to implement FITARA is the mistakes made 20 years ago won't be repeated. That's the second paragraph.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a little bit further down, he writes, FITARA in many ways isn't just updating the 1996 Clinger-Cohen Act, but reinforcing many of the requirements that the agencies ignored, misinterpreted, or that just got lost in the business of government over the last two decades. Do you agree with both of those ideas?
Yeah, I'd go even a bit further. I mean, frankly, OMB was one of those that ignored many of the provisions. Certain parts of OMB that you worked in, for example, the eGov portion, understood the role that the CIO was to perform, but the procurement office was much more relaxed about that, and the RMOs ignored it or weren't aware. So OMB, to begin with, is number one is getting religion on this, mm-hmm. and that's fantastic news. But yes, in the departments, it was all over the map. And again, Jeff has worked in an agency that fortunately had the CIO and the budget officer all in one person. It was the Department of Labor, and they had married the two to a position that was very powerful and very effective in terms of moving technology. But in other departments, they were separate. They were ships passing in the night, and there was often no similarity between what the CIO was interested in and what was going on in the appropriation or other world.
So what's the forcing mechanism, in your view, in FITARA, Jeff, that will make it work this time where it didn't work before? I mean, something that gets signed into law is the law. And if agencies will just, I'm not suggesting anybody flouted the law and intentionally said, well, I don't care if it's the law, I'm not going to do that. But whatever the reason was, a lot of stuff in Clinger-Cohen didn't happen. How do we know that it will happen this time? Or is this just an accountability issue where members would be able to go back 5 years from now and say, we told you to do this and you didn't, so we can hold you accountable for some reason?
Yeah, implementation is the key, because if passing a law would solve problems, we could pass a law against failed IT programs. We could pass a law against sad people. I mean, we pass any number of laws. I think the key here, and I'm curious for Jonathan's thought on this, is right now appropriations, the Congress will appropriate money into sub-bureaus and sub-agencies for IT projects. In the past, that money that was appropriated to them went to them. Is it now going to be actually reprogrammed or moved to the CIO through the I've lost the word, the letter. The appropriation. Okay, I've lost the word. I had it. But OMB interprets the appropriation bill and tells the agency how to allocate those funds, how to actually apportionment. That's
apportion.
It.
Okay.
How to apportion those funds into their counting mm-hmm. system. So you could ostensibly have money given to a bureau that through the apportionment process is then assigned to the CIO's budget, and then it would actually be in the accounting system under his name.
Your sense of that, John?
Yeah, again, it's the budget.
Mm-hmm.
It was never very clear what budget authority the CIO had, and it wasn't clear from OMB, and it certainly wasn't clear to the CIO in an agency, and particularly when they were new and didn't understand the whole game of budgeting. And now it's much more clear that it's not totally clear, but it's clearer that budget's going to have the final word. And
Jeff Cook's most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. USCIO Tony Scott says OMB's draft FITARA guidance aims to advance IT reform. And you can find all of the stories as selected by Jonathan Brule and Jeff Cook on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Gentlemen, a terrific countdown. It's great to see you, Jeff. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you for having me on.
And thank you, Jonathan, as always. It's great to have you back in the program as well. And you can find all of the stories, and you can listen to the program anytime you want at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Another Federal News Countdown next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose.